It's not a foregone conclusion in my professional military estimate that the Taliban automatically win in Kabul falls or any of those kind of dire predictions. That's not a foregone conclusion.
Afghanistan remains a violent place. It's Monday, May 10th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're online. Find us at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, Afghan journalists under fire. Virus infections build across India. Complications in sharing vaccine. A fiery return for a Chinese rocket. Space wine. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Top U.S. defense officials say that less than 1 week into the pullout of American troops from Afghanistan, the drawdown is going according to plan. Still, brutal violence continues as a powerful bomb blast Saturday near a girls' school in Kabul killed more than 60 people and injured more than 100 others. As VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb reports, the blast is a reminder that very real challenges remain.
The U.S. military has closed one base in Afghanistan and pulled out enough weapons and equipment to fill about 60 of these C-17 cargo planes.
Less than 1 week in, the drawdown is going according to plan.
Speaking Thursday at their first joint briefing, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Mark Milley vowed to continue aiding the Afghan military with funding and support from bases outside Afghanistan. But the leaders acknowledged big challenges looming soon, including how U.S. forces will continue to train and advise their Afghan partners.
We'll also continue to take a look at training them in perhaps other locations. We don't know. We haven't figured that out 100% yet. But also things like maintenance support and perhaps CT support from over the horizon.
The U.S. is leaving Afghanistan after nearly 20 years of war.
What we have tried for many years, which is to defeat the Taliban militarily, has not worked. And we are stalemated on the security front. We are stalemated at Doha. And sometimes it feels like we're stalemated within the Afghan government in terms of building a coherent Afghan political set inside Kabul.
And as the U.S. pulls out, Milley says Afghan forces haven't crumbled under the increased pressure.
It's not a foregone conclusion in my professional military estimate that the Taliban automatically win in Kabul falls or any of those kind of dire predictions. That's not a foregone conclusion.
The U.S. military says Afghanistan has seen 80 to 120 enemy-initiated attacks each day for the past year. That pace, along with stalled peace talks, points to a rough road ahead. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
These are among some of the top Asia headlines that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Myanmar's junta cool on commitment to ASEAN's plan for stabilizing country. Myanmar classifies resistance government as terrorist organization. Coronavirus cases still surging in India. Uyghur editor's family members charge Chinese documentary misrepresents them. China to create line of separation at Everest summit on COVID fears. Expanded coverage of these stories and so much more can be found daily at Facebook at VOA Asia, also at Instagram, Twitter, and at our voanews.com website. Let's continue with VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. A former Tolo news anchor in Afghanistan was gunned down last week, another reminder of the risks journalists face in that country. VOA's Azazul Popol, Hikmat Sorosh, and Jalal Mirzad have more from Afghanistan in this report narrated by Bejan Hamdard.
In Afghanistan's southern province of Kandahar, former Tolo News anchor Nemat Rawan, who recently joined the country's Ministry of Finance as a media official, was gunned down early Thursday. 28-year-old Rawan is the fifth journalist to be killed in the country this year. Local journalists are demanding an immediate investigation.
We are extremely concerned because this is not the first time that a journalist has been killed in Kandahar and the region. Previously, we had more journalists killed in Helmand. The situation has got intense because the previous day, the Taliban had issued new threats to journalists, and then there were reports that the head of NDS also made threatening remarks. The journalists are very concerned, and their lives are in danger.
Journalists should not be killed, as they are the people who report on the public's problems.
Although the Taliban have not claimed responsibility for Rawan's killing, the death comes a day after the Taliban accused media in Afghanistan of taking sides and issued a warning. Afghan government officials say the Taliban should focus on the peace process instead of issuing threats. Presidential spokesperson Fatima Murchal.
We don't support the situation of militarism and war in Afghanistan. Our priority is peace. Taliban have intensified their attacks but have lost the war in each battleground. So the time has come for Taliban to understand the realities of the situation on the battleground instead of wrong calculation of winning the fight, useless attacks, and threatening journalists.
At the same time, an Afghan lawmaker tweeted that the chief of the country's intelligence agency made comments in a closed meeting warning journalists against news coverage that appeared favorable to the Taliban. Media advocacy group NICE chief says it is not in either side's benefit to threaten a free press.
Neither side has the right to threaten media and journalists. Any threat against media and journalists at the time when we are moving towards peace can hurt media and the peace process.
Under increasing pressure from the Taliban and the government, some Afghan journalists are appealing to the international community for help.
The Taliban didn't specify which media or which reporter is violating, but we are in a very sensitive time of peace talks. We want the international community, especially the U.S., to bring the discussion of freedom of press and supporting media into the peace talks so we don't face threats like this in the future.
We are worried. The situation is worrisome as journalists endure pressure from both sides and have sacrificed so much. We are being killed. We want the U.S. and the international community to take a constructive step to improve the current situation and play a positive role in the peace process. Otherwise, we will lose the 20-year gains for freedom of expression in this country.
According to the Afghan Journalist Safety Committee, 43 Afghan journalists have left the country and over 1,000 others have given up on their profession due to the increase in targeted killings in the last 6 months. For Azizullah Popol in Kandahar, Hikmat Sarosh and Jalal Mirzad in Kabul, Afghanistan, Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
Happening now in Asia, ethnic Karen guerrillas burned down a Myanmar military outpost, capturing it without a fight after its garrison fled at their approach, according to a senior Karen officer. Fighting with the Myanmar army escalated after a military coup in February. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're very happy you've chosen to begin your week with us at VOA Asia. Bodies piled up at a crematorium in the Indian capital Delhi last week as relatives of coronavirus sufferers scrambled to refill life-saving oxygen cylinders. Flames rose from funeral pyres placed side by side as family members performed funeral rites. We hear more with VOA's Mariama Diallo.
Families say goodbye to loved ones as funeral workers prepare bodies for cremation. By Wednesday, the coronavirus has taken the lives of over 226,000 people in India, and the number of those infected had surpassed 20.6 million people. Amid the surge, oxygen remained in short supply.
I am here to get a cylinder refilled for a relative. I have been here since 5 in the morning. Nothing has happened so far. People are getting hassled. I hope to get one here, but many are leaving disheartened.
I've been waiting here since 4 in the morning yesterday. One night in a day has passed. They say 50 cylinders will be distributed. They check 100 documents and reject 90 out of them and accept only 10.
The list of required documents include a COVID test report, a recent medical officer's prescription order, and proof of ID. On Wednesday, a top court ordered India's government to rapidly submit a plan on how it will meet the oxygen requirements of Delhi's hospitals.
This is a very critical time in our country.
A top scientific advisor also warned the Indian government that it would inevitably face more waves of infections even after the current one subsides.
Phase 3 is inevitable, given the high levels of circulating virus. But it's not clear on what time scale this phase 3 will occur. Hopefully, incrementally, but we should prepare for new waves.
As people continue to line up for vaccines, India, a country of 1.4 billion, has so far administered 160 million vaccines. Efforts to scale up the vaccination drive have been hampered by a shortage of doses. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello anytime you're online or on your smartphone. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime.
This news from VOA Asia. Japan has extended a state of emergency in Tokyo and three other areas until the end of May to stem a surge in novel coronavirus cases fueled by the spread of virus variants just months before the Tokyo Olympics. This and all the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. More now on coronavirus as VOA Asia continues. World leaders welcome the Biden's administration announced support for waiving patent restrictions on COVID-19 vaccines, the so-called TRIPS waiver, at the World Trade Organization. This could be a breakthrough in the global fight against the pandemic, but as White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Swara tells us, it's just the first step in a long and complicated process.
With cases surging around the world, the U.S. decision to support waiving patents for COVID-19 vaccines is welcomed by more than 100 countries at the World Trade Organization, who also backed the so-called TRIPS waiver. The proposal was submitted in October 2020 by India and South Africa.
It goes to show the influence we have as a country, working together with others, that our voice and messages have weight.
The Biden administration is essentially committing to apply its convening power at the WTO to begin text-based negotiations to hammer out a compromise with countries that oppose the waiver, including the European Union, Japan, and the United Kingdom.
Sending a message multilaterally that the United States is back and the United States cares, not just about its own domestic interests, but also internationally on the multilateral stage, and is ready to play a leadership role, that's a very important signal.
But what the U.S. is supporting is narrower than the original proposal, covering only patents, not other intellectual property protections, and only vaccines, not other COVID-19-related technologies, including diagnostics and therapeutics.
We don't know what is going to happen in the actual process of formulating this text, and the extent to which the Biden administration is going to be willing to generate a compromise based on the push and pull, both at the international level, other member states, and internally. Right? Internally, you have large pharmaceutical companies that are very concerned about the waiver.
It's the first step in a long process. The WTO is consensus-based, and all members must agree to move forward. Some waiver opponents, including the EU, have signaled they are open to negotiations to address the pandemic.
And that's why we are ready to discuss how the U.S. proposal for waiver on intellectual property protection for COVID vaccines could help achieve that objective.
Once WTO members agree on a text, a process that could take months, countries will implement laws to remove the legal risks of producing generic versions of the vaccines. The hope is that it will speed up global vaccinations and reduce inequity in distribution. While some countries like the U.S. have given most of their population at least one shot, some countries have not even delivered a single shot. But the pharmaceutical industry warns that waiving patents may backfire.
You can have a sort of dangerous free-for-all where scarce supplies that are desperately needed to keep that manufacturing going end up being diverted potentially to companies that don't know what they're doing, and that will do more harm than good.
They say it's better to vaccinate the world through licensing agreements, such as the one between AstraZeneca and the Serum Institute of India. Humanitarian organizations demand these agreements meet certain standards.
It has to be transparent. It has to be worldwide available. It has to be accountable.
While the WTO deliberates on these complex intellectual property negotiations, COVID-19 surges like the one happening in India are a reminder of the urgency of vaccinating on a global scale. At Siwidakuswara, VOA News.
Making headlines in Asia, Indonesia's Mount Sinabung erupted again, spewing a thick column of volcanic ash into the sky. Villagers near the volcano in North Sumatra province have been relocated after past eruptions. There were no further evacuations or casualties from the latest blast. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the remnants from an out-of-control Chinese rocket have safely re-entered Earth's atmosphere over the Indian Ocean, according to Chinese state media. U.S. Space Command confirmed the rocket's descent over the Arabian Peninsula, but did not say where the remnants landed. Some of the reports say pieces of the rocket landed near the Maldives. VOA's Adriana Zhang spoke with Paolo Lozano, director of the Space Propulsion Lab at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, to find out more about the rocket and if the situation was preventable.
This is a stage of a rocket that was used by the Chinese to put in orbit a part of their space station. It's quite a big part of the rocket. And this part of the rocket actually doesn't have the ability to control itself for known reentry. The aerodynamic forces when these objects are falling into Earth are very severe. And the structures used in the design for these stages are not capable to withstand those kind of pressures in a single piece.
Do you think China should be responsible for cleaning up after this reentry?
They are certainly responsible for not giving enough information or enough, work on the design to prevent an uncontrolled reentry. I think that that's important. The cleanup is probably not going to be even possible. They will very likely just be lost forever in the ocean.
You're saying that this is a design flaw.
It's a design choice because, with more investment, what you can do is provide these stages with enough control. So, for example, provide propulsion and provide attitude control and communications so that you know where these objects will fall. But in this case, it was a design choice. The choice was not to include these more expensive and more complex elements into the design of the stage. So, instead, the stage is left as a non-cooperative object, basically, as a piece of debris.
So you're saying that China actually has the technology. It just decided not to use it because of the price.
It's possible that it's the price or maybe it's because of the, a design consideration, a technical consideration, for example, a weight consideration, because these elements also take mass. I don't have information of why this choice was made, but in many cases you can actually design your orbits, design the elements on your rocket stages so that this is a more controlled process.
When the U.S. designs this kind of objects that we expect them to like re-enter the Earth, what would the U.S. do?
You have a much better control of these stages. So from the moment that you launch them in a more predictable trajectory so that you know where they have the most probability of falling, or you can add these active elements so that you control with a burn of your engine where these elements will fall. That's just to make sure that they are not going to fall in a place on the Earth that could produce damage to property or people.
Is there any example you can show us that the U.S. successfully controlled the re-entry of a rocket?
These second stages, you never hear in the news that they are uncontrollably flying around and ready to return to the air in unknown places. And that's because usually they stay in orbit for a little bit, and then the engine on board performs a burn, which deorbits them in the right place at the right time.
Is there a international organization that could set some kind of regulations?
Yeah, it's always difficult to work with these legal frameworks. Every nation does this separately. There are, of course, agreements between nations on how to behave in space. Basically, what individual nations do is they work responsibly, trying to minimize the damage to people and property when they have situations like this. And the expectation is that the international community will look at all these guidelines and suggestions. But in terms of laws, we have to be responsible space citizens. The local space environment is becoming more and more crowded. There is not only danger of these objects to fall uncontrollably into the ground, but there is a significant amount of space debris that could prevent the utilization of space by all nations. So I think that making a call for people to be more responsible on how to design their devices so that they not only prevent damage to people and property, also design them to not make themselves a threat to the space environment, which provides so many services to today's world, that it'll be a very difficult situation if we put that in danger.
Paolo Lozano, director of the Space Propulsion Lab at MIT, speaking with VOA's Adriana John. The U.S. space agency NASA, meanwhile, is celebrating the 60th anniversary of Alan Shepard's history-shaping flight, plus private spaceflight sets a launch date, and wine from space lands on Earth with an out-of-this-world price tag. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more from space.
On May 5, 1961, NASA astronaut Alan Shepard became the first American in space. 6 decades later, acting NASA chief historian Brian C. Odom told VOA that mission forever changed the space agency.
The space program that we know today wouldn't have emerged and wouldn't have evolved as it has and become what it is without the accomplishment of Shepard's flight.
While Shepard was the first American in space, the first person in space by just 23 days was Soviet Yuri Gagarin. Odom says that put even more pressure on NASA to deliver a win.
If Shepard's flight isn't successful, I don't think you get a sense that Kennedy, President Kennedy at the time, is going to show the same willingness to commit to more endeavors in space. I mean, Shepard's flight is important in that, just with 15 minutes of space flight, it's enough that it gives Kennedy the confidence to say, okay, just several days later, right, he's going to go before Congress and demand more funding for space.
Alan Shepard died in 1988, but Odom says he left behind a legacy that shaped NASA's space program into the very different one we see today.
I think one of the most important things we see now is that diversification of the astronaut corps, the inclusive nature of not only the astronauts, but the workforce at NASA and across the country and across international and commercial partners.
Shepard's legacy lives on as the namesake to Blue Origin's new Shepard suborbital vehicle. The private spaceflight company owned by Amazon founder Jeff Bezos just announced that it will fly auction winners aboard the new Shepard for the first time on July 20th. Finally this week, VOA previously reported on an experiment aboard the International Space Station to research how bottled wine would develop outside Earth's atmosphere. 12 bottles left the ISS in January after 14 months in space. Now, one of those bottles is up for sale. It comes with a second bottle of the same $10,000 wine that never left Earth. Tim Tiptree from auction house Christie's says it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
And the lucky buyer of this, a unique lot will be able to taste it's a galactic version against the terrestrial version because you get one of each. So, that'll be a fascinating, tasting to do.
Christie's expects the bottle to fetch about $1 million at auction. The company's website says proceeds of the sale will go toward funding future space missions. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Time for us to splash down. That's our VOA Asia program for today. We invite you to come back again tomorrow. In the meantime, follow us online at Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and of course, Facebook. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our team, Service Chief Diane Gao, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day ahead. Be safe. Be well.